We're hearing the orchestral interlude from the choral symphony work, The Prison. This is The First Glimmer of Dawn. It was released in August, originally from 1930. It's the major last work of British composer Dame Ethel Smyth. We're talking about the Madison connection to it and a Grammy to behold here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Prison, it's a conversation between a prisoner at the end of life and his soul searching for peace. Do you know this work, The Prison? How does classical music move you? Are you a classical singer? What can you say about your work? 800-642-1234. Sarah Braley took home a Grammy Sunday for Best Classical Solo Vocal Album for Smyth, The Prison. She's a soprano singer in Madison. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network and congratulations.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
How does it feel? How does it feel to win a Grammy?
It feels pretty surreal, but wonderful.
Oh, tell us about your project here, how you got into this work on this particular project. What's behind it?
Sure. Yeah, it really all came together because of the conductor, James Blatchley. He's also a composer. And so when I was living in New York up until a few years ago, I was contracted to sing a piece of his. And the classical music community in New York is very small. So we had known of each other, but we had yet to meet. And I sang his piece and he enjoyed, you know, it was a great experience. I loved the piece. He loved my singing. And he said, you know, I'm doing this project, this new edition of this amazing piece, and we're going to do a recording. Would you be interested in being the soprano soloist?
I mean, this was my first entree into this composer. Why did he pick this piece, this composer?
Well, you're right. She's not very well known, which is one of the exciting things about this whole project and the Grammy, bringing her name to the wider world. He had been invited to conduct excerpts from the piece about 6 years ago, and he discovered how incredible it was and that there was only a manuscript, so a handwritten score up to that point. So James actually took on the task of creating a modern edition, so it would be more easily accessible in the future. And he fell in love with the piece through the process, and that's kind of how it all started.
Yeah, you know, Ethel Smyth, she passed away in 1944, but the words describing her are just amazing. Outspoken, risk-taker, bold, boundary-pushing, creative. How would you describe her as a composer up against this work, her final major work, The Prison?
Yeah, she sounds really formidable, doesn't she?
I want to meet her. Let's go back in time.
I wish, right? Yeah, she was truly an independent spirit, from all accounts, and her music is stunningly beautiful. I mean, it, you know, has a bit of Brahms or Mahler flavor in it, but it's also truly her own. The form of the piece is very unique, and it's very it's sort of, I guess if you were to equate it to writing, it would be kind of stream of consciousness. It's very through composed. There's not individual movements that you can excerpt and play on their own. And just the fact that it's this concert piece, but with two real characters is pretty unique, the prisoner and his soul.
We're talking with Sarah Braley, who's a soprano based in Madison, who just won the Grammy for Best Classical Solo Vocal Album. We're talking about The Prison, the background to it. What do you want to know about this particular work? Are you a classical music fan? Have you heard of Ethel Smyth, the late British composer? Join in, 800-642-1234. So let's listen to a bit more of The Prison. This is toward the end of the symphony. It's called number 15, Death Calls Him, Glorying He Obeys the Summons. Mm. It's just stunning, Sarah. Can you tell us about this point and your role in it?
Yeah, this is, I think, the penultimate movement of the piece. It's the point where the prisoner and the soul are really about to be in dialogue and sing together, which doesn't happen very many times in the piece. We sort of are in monologue for most of the beginning and middle of the piece. And it all comes together, and there's this very joyous section where the two of us sing together after this, and then it ends serenely, and you know, we get the impression that the prisoner has indeed found peace.
Mm. I feel like there's that tension, that push-pull of imprisonment, but also freedom, of release, of peace. How did you approach that in this work?
We'll be honest, it was a difficult piece to sing. Mm-hmm. And so it took a lot of work, you know, technical work. And I was glad to have an extended period of time to do that. And so it really just allowed me to live with the text. The text is by a very close friend, maybe lover of Ethel Smythe's, Henry Brewster. It's this very existential work of the same title, The Prison. So, you know, our role as singers, we have the unique advantage of having text, which instrumentalists don't have. So I think everything we get is motivated by the text.
And you have to kind of read into the text and, you know, really embrace it, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
So she was a suffragist, jailed, I understand, you know, around 1910 after a political protest. Can you tell us about just her her background there in women's rights?
Yeah, I mean, that's another reason why she's such an admirable figure. She actually took 2 years off from her musical career to devote herself to the suffrage cause in Britain and became very close with the leaders of the suffrage movement. And in fact, she composed a piece, The March of the Women, that became the official suffrage anthem. And there's this great story about the time she was in prison for 2 months, I believe. And this group of suffragettes came to the prison courtyard singing the March of Women. And she leaned out the window and conducted them with her toothbrush.
Oh my goodness.
So she was quite a character.
And you released this at a time, you know, this summer to coordinate with the ratification of the 19th Amendment.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's been such a tough year for everybody, but, you know, for performing artists, we, you know, saw a year ago, exactly, pretty much all our concerts get canceled and all these projects that we were excited about, many of which, or several of which for me included suffrage related projects. So I was so glad that I at least had this recording coming out in August to bring attention to the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And it really made for a great narrative, and I'm so glad that Smythe is getting the attention she deserves.
We're talking with Sarah Braley, a classical singer in Madison and now Grammy Award winner for Best Classical Solo Vocal Album. Have you listened to The Prison? What does it make you feel? Are you familiar with the British composer, Ethel Mary Smythe? What do you want to know about her life, her works? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Sarah Braley here on the Ideas Network. This is the orchestral interlude from the choral symphony, The Prison. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The original work was composed in 1930 by Dame Ethel Smythe, but it's brought to life, reimagined by soprano Sarah Braley and fellow musicians on the album called Smythe the Prison. It was released in August, as we've been talking about, to coincide with the 19th Amendment centennial, granting women the right to vote. Braley, she's just won a Grammy for the album. What are your thoughts on the Grammys awarding a female composer? Have you heard music from the Prison Symphony? How does it make you feel? 800-642-1234. And soprano Sarah Braley stays with us for about 10 more minutes. You know, Sarah, if this work explores the prison of our mind and our pursuit of truth, our pursuit of peace, I'm wondering, did you find new clarity or new meaning by working on this project?
Well, I don't know if I found, well, maybe I did find clarity. I mean, as we've talked about, Smythe's story is so simultaneously inspirational, but frustrating, because she fought her whole life for acceptance into this male-dominated world. Her music was criticized for being both too feminine and too masculine. You just can't win. And yet she enjoyed some very important successes in her life. She was the first female composer that the Metropolitan Opera produced an opera by in 1903. And I would just note that it took them more than a century to do another one. It wasn't until 2016 with Kaija Saariaho's L'Amour de Loin. Excuse me. So I hope they're catching up now. But, you know, as women, I think we all see that despite how far we've come, we're still, that there's still so much work to do. So I'm so happy and honored to be a part of telling Dame Smythe's story and bringing her music to the world, because it's just as worthy as her fellow male composers.
Well, let's take a call now. And Sarah, this might be someone you recognize. This is Jan in La Crosse. Hi, Jan.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning, Sarah.
Good. Is this Jan Sahagian?
Yes, it is. How are you? I am just over the moon about your award, and I'm thrilled to be able to actually talk to you. We haven't talked in a few years, and I'm just bursting with congratulations. I can't express it enough. And for the rest of you, I was Sarah's singing teacher when she was 11 years old. And she had a phenomenal voice back then. I knew, you know, at the first time I heard her, that this was an unusual talent. This was a gift. And she has the intellect and the beauty to go along with it. Mm-hmm. And she just, it was so much fun watching her all through middle school and then in high school as well. So for 7 years, develop her talent. And we are so blessed here in La Crosse to have had her here. And I'm hoping that now that the rest of Wisconsin and the United States and the world knows how talented she is, that she will continue to sing and grace us with her voice.
Oh, that's just so beautiful, Jan. I have tears. What, I may ask, Jan, what did you try to instill in her at a young age?
The passion for music. And I was always a technical teacher. So, you know, we went over dynamics and we went over diction, and Sarah took to it like a fish to water. She did it all, and she did it with precision. And I saw the passion develop in her. And that she wasn't planning on going into music originally, but with all of her experiences here, I think it changed her mind.
Oh, Jan, thank you. Sarah, does this all sound right? What can you say?
Absolutely.
You're being put on the spot.
No, Miss Sahagin, it's so nice to hear from you. And she was such a big influence on me during those years. And I remember how hard she made us work. It was inspiring, and I'm grateful for it. And you have such a good memory. I was planning on being a doctor like my dad. And it was the experiences I had in the public music program in La Crosse that made me decide to go into music.
Oh, that's so great. Jan, thank you so much for calling in. That was just so brilliant. Sarah, what do you think of the younger generation of musicians and really, you know, maybe starting early at, and really getting that ability to sing with others?
That's such a good question, and you know, it makes me a little emotional, especially right now during the pandemic, because singing together is has been, you know, forbidden for the past year. And it my colleagues and I knew this beforehand, but feel it even more palpably now, how communal singing is such a important emotional experience. And those early experiences I had in La Crosse were, you know, shaped who I was as a musician, but also as a person. And it's so important that children have those experiences. And I hope that people think about how during this past year they've turned to TV and film and books and music to get them through this incredibly difficult time. And I hope people can make that connection and support the arts on the other side of this, because a lot of groups have failed. I think all arts groups are struggling right now, and it's important to support independent arts groups and arts education in the public school system, because it's what makes us human.
We're talking with Sarah Braley, who is a Madison-based classical singer and a 2021 Grammy Award winner for Best Classical Solo Vocal Album. Sarah, what have you been doing in the pandemic? And, you know, just that thought of not being able to sing with other people, not being, you know, having to be remote, what have you poured yourself into?
Well, I'm also getting my doctorate, so that has kept me busy. I'm trying to finish my dissertation right now. But you know, as musicians, we're really good at adapting. So we have done a lot of, and I have done a lot of remote recording and remote teaching. We've all gotten very good at Zoom, and become casual or amateur audio engineers. We all have even we appreciated them before, but we have newfound respect for the talents of our
Sure do.
audio engineer friends. So yeah, but we all are dying to get back to the stage and to rehearsals and seeing our friends and colleagues. So it's coming.
Getting back to the prison for a moment, what do you think that Ethel Smyth would say in her Grammy acceptance speech?
I think she'd say about time. She was defiant, and I think she was well aware of her gifts and her skill. I just wish she could hear it in the premiere of the piece back in, I think it was 1934. She was almost completely deaf. So it's a poignant story to think that by the time her final piece was performed, she could barely hear it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you just about that. This was a huge, large-scale work, and right before the end of her career, as she was becoming deaf, did I mean, I'm wondering where, I wonder what it was like for her to write this, knowing that this might be her last.
I'm sure it was incredibly emotional, but it also goes to show how incredible she was to really hear that in her head, and to be able to. I mean, who know? I don't know exactly how deaf she was during the composition process, but you know, if she was, to be able to hear that in her head as opposed to out loud is pretty incredible to compose like that.
we're just wrapping up here, but I'm wondering, you know, this work really challenged you. How did you have to grow as a classical music singer to take it on?
Well, it's a unique piece because it requires a lot of different kinds of singing. So it requires a lot of flexibility technically and emotionally. A lot of it's sort of, you know, sits in the mid-high range and it's very serene and peaceful. So I'm grateful for everything it taught me.
Well, Jan would say, you got that, Sarah. We went over this.
Yes, we did.
Oh, Sarah, thank you for joining us. Congratulations.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Sarah Braley is a classical singer in Madison and a new Grammy Award winner for Best Classical Solo Vocal Album. Ahead this hour, we kick off March Madness talking with a Wisconsin sports reporter about what to watch for and how the number 9 seed Badgers might fare in the big dance, and your insights as well. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about a regional snack.
Sarah Krause from Algoma wrote to our Wisconsin project and asked us, what is Matunke, the under-the-radar Czech snack eaten in northeastern Wisconsin? Good question, Sarah. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy had a Zoom cooking lesson with Sarah and her friend, Scott Prokash, to learn more about the treat and its origins.
What is it that makes Matunke so intriguing?
It's funny when somebody tries Matunke for the first time, they start chewing on it and they're like, what?
Why? If you don't tell them what's in it, right?
They're like, why am I eating this? But then they'll eat one, and then all of a sudden they're back there having another piece going, oh, this is kind of intriguing, you know?
The ingredients are humble and somewhat predictable when you think about Czech food. There's sauerkraut, some flour, a little bit of salt, and then a healthy amount of cracklings. Or in other words, browned pork fat.
The best way to describe Matunke is to say it's interesting. It looks gray, like a cross between cardboard and oatmeal. It's kind of crisp and kind of doughy.
Vani Kanjerski is a master Matunke maker from Kewanee. She's more straightforward in her description.
I just say it's like a flat sauerkraut cookie. Mm-hmm.
It's a simple recipe. Dump all of the ingredients into a bowl and then get your hands dirty with the mixing. Sarah and Scott show me how via Zoom.
So I would describe the consistency of mine right now is kind of like pie dough, a little bit sticky, but not too much. Oh yeah, this looks good. Mine's sort of similar. Mine's a little messier.
Next, roll out the dough. You're aiming for a crispy but still slightly chewy texture. So roll it out to about a quarter inch, cut it, then bake it at 400 degrees for roughly 15 minutes.
It is a sticky mess. So you got to flour the heck out of everything.
Okay, more and flour than you think you need.
Oh my God, the first time I made it, it was sticking to my rolling pin, my hands, my belly. I mean, I was in big trouble.
All right, doing the cutting. They aren't going to be pretty, but it is pretty satisfying to cut this with a pizza cutter.
That's a good move.
I don't think they had those in Czechoslovakia in 1800, but
I don't think so.
Sarah and Scott wanted to know about the origins of Matunke, and while I tried to do my research, I couldn't find a lot of information on the dish. In Wisconsin, it appears to be a fairly hyper-local food in the Kewanee County area, where many Czech immigrants settled. Vani says it's classic farm cooking. They had the ingredients on hand, and nothing went to waste. If you do find the recipe written down, it's most likely in a local church cookbook.
And it's mostly like word of mouth. It's not going to be in the recipe books. I've even looked in old recipe books. I've not found it.
Matunke is a huge hit in Vani's family. And every summer, she makes 40 pans of it with her husband at the Czech Fest in Algoma.
Everybody just clamors over it. And it just disappears. It just flies off the bar counter right away.
At this point in my cooking lesson with Scott and Sarah, the kitchen is starting to smell phenomenal, and the Matunke has a nice golden brown color. To be clear, I love sauerkraut and have high expectations.
It smells so good.
Let's do it while it's warm, yeah.
All right, let's do it.
That's good.
Mm,
mm-hmm.
You got a good crisp on the bottom of these.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
It takes a minute for, like, the sauerkraut flavor to set in, but it's good.
Do you think you'll bring this to like your next social gathering in 2022?
I think I will. I would make this again for sure. Really good.
Well, I wonder if you could take it to the next level with cheese in it.
Go ahead and add some cheese, or like Scott, sprinkle it with caraway seeds. Whatever sounds good to you. If you can't find cracklings, lard also works well as a substitute. And as Vani would say,
put some happy in that recipe.
Right.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on Matunky, a Czech snack found in northeastern Wisconsin. And that story idea came from an audience member as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now the field is set. 68 teams descended on Indiana for the big dance. The NCAA men's basketball tournament first round starts at noon. Badgers tip off against North Carolina Tar Heels at 6:10 tonight. Limited in-person attendance. More on that later. Are you watching the NCAA tournament this year? Who is winning in your bracket? Have you been watching the Badgers this year? How do they look to you? 800-642-1234. Justice Cleveland is sports director at WEAU-TV in Eau Claire. Justice, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, so normally the tournament is spread out at all those regional sites all over the country. How is this March Madness different, all self-contained in Indiana?
Yeah, it's amazing what they're doing with basically using the city of Indiana as a and some surrounding communities as a bubble for the whole tournament. I mean, usually you have the big town, like you said, you have the regional sites and then you have the tournament, which was in Indianapolis in 2015. But the fact that they're using all the facilities there in Indiana is basketball crazy. If any state, as Minnesota would be the hockey state in the United States, Indiana is the basketball state in the United States. So it works out perfectly with all the facilities that they have, that you're hoping that they can keep everybody distanced. And, you know, I think they only had like 9 positive tests of all the tests that they did so far. So out of the thousands that are there, you hope that things can work out without a hitch.
But the bracket structure is still the same, right?
Yes. Yep. Everything's still the same. You had yesterday was the play-in games, basically the first 4 for them to get into the field of 64. So yeah, there's still 64 teams that are in the Indianapolis area vying to finish off their season as champions.
So as you look at the safety measures, are they more stringent, say, than the NBA's bubble in Orlando last summer, or when you look at the Super Bowl last month? How do those venues kind of stack up with what you've been seeing put together here for the tournament?
It sounds like, from what I'm hearing, is that it's similar to what they did with kind of with the NBA bubble. Obviously, now you have limited fans in attendance, which we didn't have in the NBA last year. But yeah, I mean, I believe they're getting on game day. They get tested twice right before, so they get tested the night before, and then they get tested again, either like in the middle of the night or in the morning, and so they're doing what they can, and that's going to still be a big storyline the whole time. I think Georgia Tech lost one of their best players to COVID protocols, so they won't have him for the weekend, and then you just got to worry about all the contact tracing and all that goes with that. So they do wear, a lot of the teams wear the monitor so that they can't be in contact or too close of contact with another player for too long, and just a lot of different protocols just to make sure that if somebody does test positive, that it doesn't spread to the rest of the team.
How are the teams looking now? What are you seeing out there?
It's going to be interesting. It really is. I mean, this is a year that there wasn't a whole lot of like non-conference matchups. So a lot of these teams didn't play other teams from different conferences. So with the Big Ten, which is considered maybe the best conference in the country, Wisconsin got beat up at the end of the year playing a really tough conference, but you don't know how they're going to stack up against a lot of these other conferences. So it is probably about as tough of a bracket to predict that there has been. And I mean, my bracket's usually busted by the first weekend anyway, but this week, I mean, if you can get a dartboard at some point, I think you might have better luck because it's just going to be a lot of matchups that no one's seen.
Well, you know, the Badgers, ESPN said they're allergic to momentum, you know, because they didn't win consecutive games since the third week of January. You know, how are they looking? I mean, how much does that momentum matter?
It's very interesting. The Badgers have always been a team, going back to probably the Bo Ryan era, that can seem like they can beat any team in college basketball, but can also lose to any team in college basketball, just depending on the night. And the last month and a half, it's been a struggle for them. They've been in close, and I mentioned the Big Ten is such a stacked conference. They've been close in a lot of these games, but they haven't been able to finish. And it's puzzling because they have more experienced players than most teams in college basketball. They're one of the oldest teams in college basketball because they have so many seniors, but it hasn't translated to clutch performances. Now, does that mean they can't get hot here in the tournament? No, I mean, they could. They're one of those teams where with your bracket, you could write them in to win three or four games, or you could be like, well, I don't know if they're going to be able to get past North Carolina. So it's been a very puzzling year to watch a team that won the Big Ten championship last year, returned most of the same players, but it somehow it hasn't translated to a lot of late season success.
Has COVID played into this at all? You know, as players try to navigate this as well in their campuses and in their training?
I think it has. I think just the fan part of it. Oh. I mean, the Kohl Center is usually just packed. You have rowdy fans there. You have all that. And I don't know what it would be like to be playing at this high of a competitive level, but be like you're playing a pickup game at the YMCA. You know, you do have your, you know, you have your bench fans cheering for you. But, yeah, I think COVID really has. I think it's kind of a hard season to read the tea leaves in a way, just because of all that these players are going through. And, yeah, you're still seeing coaching changes. You're still seeing all that stuff. But I feel like you almost have to give a pass to a lot of the players and the coaches because they're navigating something that's never been navigated before.
Yeah, yeah. How is UNC looking to you?
They're looking real tough if you're the Badgers. They are a very tall, athletic team, which has given the Badgers fits this season. They have three guys, Armando Bacot, Garrison Brooks, and Davon Sharp, who are forwards that are around 6'11". So they have these three guys that are monsters in the middle that it's going to be tough for the Badgers to stop on. The Badgers, Nate Reavers and Micah Potter, are their two main big guys, and they've struggled to be consistent, Reavers for sure. So North Carolina, obviously we have two teams here that are traditional March Madness teams, North Carolina having a long history as well. So it's one of those games where, you know, I think North Carolina's favored by 1.5. So it's basically a pick 'em, flip a coin. And I think that's what a lot of people are probably doing with their brackets is just flipping a coin to see who wins. It should be a really good game.
We have sports director at WEAU-TV, Justice Cleveland. He's getting us set up for the men's NCAA basketball tournament. The Badgers haven't won an NCAA tournament game since 2017. Is this their year? Who is winning in your bracket? What questions do you have about how the NCAA is taking COVID precautions? Still time to talk about March Madness, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Justice Cleveland here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about March Madness. It's been nearly 2 years, right, since college basketball fans could watch the big dance play out. The NCAA has a schedule with a big caveat. All dates are tentative because of changing conditions brought about by COVID. What do you think of having tournament play in the pandemic? Who will make it to the Final Four? How do the Badgers look to you? Join in, 800-642-1234. We have WEAU-TV Sports Director Justice Cleveland, who is our guide to the hoops. Justice, how do you pace yourself? How do you digest March Madness, especially for, you know, I'm the casual basketball, you know, game watcher. I can't watch all of these games. So how do you pick and choose?
Oh, it's tough because of at least the way they stagger it helps a little bit. They don't have everybody starting at the same time, so they kind of stagger the start times into like a half hour, which is a very smart move by CBS to just attract viewers to the end of games. If there's an exciting ending, you can go from one to another. A lot of it for me is just, you know, looking at the scoreboards online and saying, okay, well, this game looks pretty close. Let's flip over here. Yeah, multiple TVs does help too. Multiple, in this day and age of multiple screens, I think that's the thing about March Madness, is it's pretty much built for that, especially these first couple days when you have so many teams playing. It's built for the digital age at this point, that, you know, finding ways to watch multiple games. So, yeah, it's a lot of scoreboard watching and just, you know, social media seeing, like, oh, somebody saying, hey, turn it over to this game, it's really close. So that's basically the best way you can do it, is just kind of keep that scoreboard up and see, hey, okay, let's flip over to this one now.
Stay flexible, stay open, right? Open to teams.
Do your stretching in the morning so you're ready to go.
Right. So let me ask you this. You know, here we are in Indiana. Most of these games are in Indianapolis or the surrounding area, where the Badgers lost the national championship game in 2015 to Duke. How significant could those memories be?
Well, maybe for Greg Gard would be the most.
Okay.
He was the assistant to Bo Ryan at that point, but most of the players that, you know, that's probably, a lot of them were probably seniors in high school at that point, which it's scary because I was there in 2015 and it doesn't feel like it's been 6 years ago, but it just tells you how quick time flies. But yeah, I mean, that was an emotional time for Wisconsin, for the program and for their fans. I mean, that's as close as they've came to ever winning a national title. And they were there in that game against Duke in that championship game. So I think it's going to be very emotional, especially if you're one of the limited number of fans that do get to go down there. You're going to have the memories of that Lucas Oil Stadium where they played the game, of being jam-packed with fans and cheering it on. And it's going to be a completely different atmosphere. I was watching some of those games last night. They had the first four games for the play-ins, and it almost seems like a Friday morning lecture at a college. You got scattered people here or there, but it's not a full lecture room because you just can't right now. So it kind of seems it's going to be interesting to watch. But saying that, it's going to be nice, kind of refreshing to have fans again in attendance and cheering on teams, because we haven't really had that for a year.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Greg Gard. What does his program have to prove this year?
That's really interesting, because last year they would have came into the tournament with, we were talking about momentum earlier, with a ton of momentum. They were playing their best basketball. They just won the Big Ten championship, and then, you know, the season was cut off. This year they came in with all, you know, thinking that momentum would carry over to this year, and it did early on, but it really hasn't late. I think with the experience of the team, with all the seniors they have, you would hope that they could have at least get a win in the opening round. They're going to run into a buzzsaw that is Baylor in the second round if they do win. Not saying Baylor somehow doesn't get, you know, the rare, there's only been one 16-1 upset in the history of college basketball. So I think if Wisconsin could win a couple of games, that would be huge. If they make it to the Sweet 16, I think that would be a big victory, considering how the end of the season has went.
How does Gonzaga look to you?
I mean, for me, I have them with, now, that's not a surprise, because I think a majority of brackets have them winning. But that team, you know, we talked about experience, and that's another team that has a lot of – that are able to get kids to go for 4 years. You know, the Kentuckys and the Dukes and North Carolinas get a lot of kids that come play basketball, and then, you know, they're moving on to the pros, while Gonzaga and, like, a Wisconsin are able to keep those kids for 4 years, and that usually translates to victory. I mean, if you look at Gonzaga, they could be the first mid-major to get a championship, and that's a smaller school. So I think a lot of people are putting their hopes on their brackets that Gonzaga can live up to the hype.
We're talking with Justice Cleveland, sports director at WEAU-TV in Eau Claire, looking at March Madness. Are you watching the NCAA tournament this year? Who is winning in your bracket? Have you been watching the Badgers this year? What do you think? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Justice, players don't wear masks during games, but coaches do. And there's been some criticism of coaches who are regularly pulling those masks down to talk to players, to talk to the refs. What does that mean? Is there a penalty or a fine, or what happens in those situations?
That's a good question, because I think there's warnings, obviously, that they can get that. But I don't know what the real repercussions are now. Like the NFL this season, there were fines levied towards head coaches if they were breaking mask protocol on the sideline during games. But I haven't really heard a whole lot about college basketball. And it's interesting, because here, like in Wisconsin with high school basketball, the players wore masks. They weren't obviously going through the testing protocols. that, you know, the D1 college athletes are, but they wore masks, as did the Division III players from the state schools around here too. So it can be done with masks. And after a while, you know, just covering it, you don't even realize it because it's just something that's become normal in life in general. And so it kind of surprised me that they decided to do it without the masks. But, you know, the NCAA has more money than a lot of, you know, the smaller divisions of college do. They're going to give more money to Division I. And then the high school players, I mean, we were able to navigate a season here in Wisconsin. So I think the masks help. I really do. But, yeah, with the coaches, you'll see it. And, you know, today if you're watching, you'll see a lot of them pull down the mask to yell and then pull the mask back up. So it's interesting. We'll see if there is any warnings given during this tournament. Because, I mean, more eyes are going to be on these games than any games all season.
Well, it's interesting. You see players at the younger level, local level, you know, that where it almost the mask almost becomes maybe a piece of their uniform that they don't even recognize it anymore.
Right. And I think, you know, they just want to play. So, you know, they're going to do whatever it takes. And putting on the mask, I think we've seen it in all these different sports. It becomes something, at times you have to pull it back up. And it's like anything that, you know, you tie your shoe. Well, you know, you pull your mask back up, too. So it's stuff like that. But it's amazing how resilient and adaptable the kids in the state were. So it was kind of surprising to see that they didn't adapt something like that. College basketball Division I level, but then again with all the testing they have, it's a little different.
Let's go to Ben now in Wausau. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have two questions. I was surprised to hear that the games were starting on Friday. I thought they'd be starting Thursday like they did in the past, and I'm curious about the locations. Will they be using the colleges in the vicinity of Indianapolis, like, for example, DePaul and Greencastle or Butler? And I'll take my my answers off the air.
Ben, thanks. Go ahead, Justice.
And yes, they scheduled it. They staggered it a little differently there. I think they just don't want to spread it out as more than usually what they do is, like, it's 3 weeks. I think they're trying to compact it a little bit more just because you're going to have so many people in one area. So I think they're just trying to compact the schedule a little bit more, and that's why they started on a Friday this year. Usually it is a Thursday. As for the facilities, yes, they're using all the local colleges they can to spread out the teams. Hinkle Fieldhouse, that's where Butler plays. That's was used. Mackey Arena, that's where the Badgers are going to be playing. That's where Purdue plays, and that's in West Lafayette. Then obviously you have Lucas Oil Stadium, which is a huge venue as well, and I'm probably forgetting Bankers Life Arena. I don't know if they're using that. That's where the Pacers play too. So I mean, it's like I said earlier, it's Indiana. There are plenty of basketball facilities, and that's why they picked Indianapolis.
Well, Justice, thank you for joining us. Happy watching.
Oh yeah, you too. I think there's gonna be a lot of people. Don't if you're picking your brackets off of me, I take no blame.
Justice Cleveland, sports director at WEAU TV in Eau Claire. Just ahead, the author of the new book Sidelined reveals what it's like to be a woman in sports media, a woman sports broadcaster in a male-dominated space. Are you a woman in a male-dominated industry? What is it like? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.